You're listening to Heartland Politics with Robin Johnson, a presentation of WVIK, Quad Cities, NPR.
Hi, everybody, and welcome back to the Heartland Politics show and podcast, which is aired on and distributed by WVIK, Quad Cities, NPR. WVIK is the flagship public radio station in the Quad Cities region of eastern Iowa and northwestern Illinois. I'm your host, Robin Johnson, and I'm really looking forward to today's show because I have Aaron Murphy back, who I think is the most popular guest I've had on my show over the years, certainly the most frequent. Aaron's here to talk a little bit about the election results this week. Some interesting outcomes, some surprises, some not so surprises. But Aaron, of course, is the chief statehouse reporter of politics and government for the Gazette. And Aaron, thanks so much for taking the time. I know you're probably tired and ready to rest up a little bit, but you got to get this done first.
Still running on adrenaline, so I'm okay for now. Thanks as always for having me, Robin.
Yeah, well, it's interesting. I was back on the national map after some years when perhaps it wasn't. We'll still wait for the fall to see if it's truly going to have any significant change. But let's start right at the top where we had primaries for the U.S. Senate for the vacant seat that Joni Ernst is leaving. Of course, Ashley Henson had a primary, but let's talk about that Democratic primary. What happened, and what did you see? Were you surprised any by the results?
I wasn't necessarily surprised that Josh Turek won that primary over Zach Walls from what we had sort of been hearing on the campaign. It certainly seemed like Turek, and I wouldn't have guaranteed going into it that I knew Josh Turek was going to win, but it sure felt like it was leaning in his direction. I think there's a pretty clear case to be made that the ads that came in support of him from the Vote Vets group did their job and got his name ID boosted at a time when maybe it needed it and had a good message. So that he won didn't surprise me. I was a little bit surprised by the margin and how fast that race was called Tuesday night. That happened a little quicker than I expected. I guess I thought maybe it was going to be a little closer than it was.
I have to echo that. I had both candidates on my show over the last couple of weeks, and they sounded fairly familiar on the issues, which is, as you know, I try to keep focused on, and the major difference was insider versus outsider. And it just seemed like, I don't know, if I would have bet money, I would have said that would have been within 10 points.
Yeah, same here. I definitely didn't see a 50,000 vote margin like we did there. Both candidates, like you said, they were very similar on the issues, and both seemed to be, like, I got the sense, and my colleague Tom Barden covered this race more than I did because I focused on the gubernatorial primary, but from the sense I got from most Iowa Democrats was that they liked both candidates, and it was just a matter of picking which one that they thought was better equipped to take on Ashley Henson this summer and fall. The fact that the margin was as wide as it was took me by surprise a little bit too. Absolutely,
the electability factor. I mean, that's interesting because we sometimes, you know, we think voters just go and pick the candidate they like the best, but that certainly may have entered into it. I'm curious. You know, Tom Harkin, who had the Senate seat last, came out with the endorsement of Josh Turek. And I don't know, it seemed like that would have made a big difference. I'm not sure. Do you think it did in the end?
I think it probably moved some needles. How much, that's so difficult to tell, but you know, when you're talking about endorsements, most of the experts will tell you most of them don't matter a whole lot. There's very few that actually do. But you can definitely make a case that in this primary, that Tom Harkin is a name that still carries weight with Iowa Democrats. Like you noted, he's literally the last Iowa Democrat to hold a Senate seat. So if there is a list of names of whose endorsements would have mattered in this race, Tom Harkin's was right at the top of that. So I got to believe it had some impact. Now, is it the explanation for a 50,000 vote difference? Very unlikely.
It seemed like both had interesting narratives on my show. Walls, of course, talked about his narrative of talking, being raised by his two parents who were both women, and the gay marriage issue. And then Josh Turk, of course, being in a wheelchair, participating in the Paralympics, crawling up stairs to reach voters. They both had compelling narratives. But I noticed the national press, which was interesting, tried to come in and make this a bigger play between Chuck Schumer versus Elizabeth Warren. I really don't know that that played into it that much.
I certainly don't think it did among the voters. Zach Walls tried to hit on that a little bit. It wasn't his only message, but he did bring that up, and as you talked about it, some of the core messages was outsider versus, that was part of Zach's message. I'm the outside, the status quo candidate. He said that Josh Turk was the, handpicked. So that was part of the case that Zach made, but I don't believe that was something ultimately that made Iowa Democrats pull the lever, is what I like to say. Well, when they actually pulled the lever, what's going through their mind? And I don't think Chuck Schumer and Elizabeth Warren were in the voting booths with many Iowa Democrats yesterday.
I don't either. But the national press, the articles I saw, they paid attention to this late, it seemed like, and came in, and that seemed to be the narrative they were putting together. Are you familiar, Aaron, and maybe Tom that's more familiar, but I'm curious about this group Vote Vets. Do you know much about them? Who funds them? I mean, they put some serious money into this, and I do think those TV ads showing Josh in a wheelchair, just that in itself, I think, provided a narrative for voters that this was somebody unique.
Yeah, I don't, to be perfectly honest. I apologize. I don't have a lot of good background on them. But that is the one thing I do know. You're absolutely right, and I kind of alluded to it earlier. It's not just the money and the ads that they put in. They did a good job. I mean, there is, by any objective measure, those were ads were very well done and very effective at telling a good story. And kind of noteworthy that they did it without any mudslinging, right? That those ads were all about Josh Turk and telling his story, giving his bio, and putting that out there. And clearly, those were, got Josh's story out there to probably a lot of people who didn't know that, unlike, those of us who covered the State House and knew Josh well before this campaign. Obviously, there's a lot of people who don't tune into that stuff every day. And so those ads got that bio in front of a lot of people who hadn't heard it before. So they were very, very effective in that way.
It just seemed like an election based more on just the narratives and candidate character than issues, because I don't remember hearing any real differences on issues. Although I will say this, I thought Walls spoke more powerfully about economic issues, and that's no slight against Josh, but just the answers he gave, there seemed to be some real energy and passion behind those. But again, this isn't. And I also think, Aaron, Josh's district is mostly Iowa City, which is a blue district.
Zach's district is
Iowa City. Zach's district, I'm sorry. Then Josh came from a working class district out there, a Trump district that he barely won. So maybe voters were looking at that a little bit too. Although you and I don't, but I think the national reporters try to complicate things. I think this came down to just narratives told by pictures.
Yeah, absolutely. And like you said, in those bios, and I do think if there was any more common theme than anything else. It was, you know, Iowa Democrats have a lot of hopes for this year in this general election and this fall. And I think the most common question for those voters was, who's going to give us the best chance to beat Ashley Hinson? I think that, and then what that means is different to each individual voter. You know, is it because I think someone's a fighter? Is it because I think they're able to win in a purple district like Joshua? Or is it because I think an outsider has the best? Those are the kind of, you know, everybody defines electability. We talk about electability as an argument, but electability means something different to every voter. But that's ultimately whatever that calculation was. I think that was why I think clearly, you know, 120,000 Iowa Democrats thought that Josh Turek gives them the best chance to win this fall, and that's how we are where we are.
Before we turn to the governor's race real quickly, Ashley Hinson did have primary opposition, but it wasn't really close. Any evidence that she's coming out of this anything but unified with the party? There weren't any scars from this at all?
No, not at all. In fact, we've seen other Republican primaries with incumbents losing a lot more ground in the primary than she did. Marianne Miller Meeks has yielded some fairly big numbers to primary challengers in the past, and even Chuck Grassley had a big number. Ashley Hinson's was, 25% is not nothing, but it's not like we've seen in some other races. So no, I think she's been basically the de facto general election candidate from day one. She's good at that. She's good at getting out in front of Iowans. She's good at talking to the press. She'll be a formidable candidate without a doubt. And I know Democrats know that. And so I don't see any stumbling blocks for her coming out of the gate.
You're listening to Heartland Politics on WVIK, Quad Cities NPR. I'm your host, Robin Johnson, and my guest today is Aaron Murphy from The Gazette. He writes politics and governmental issues for The Gazette, and he's a frequent guest on my show. And we're here talking about the really big primary election results from Tuesday night in Iowa. And again, Iowa's on the map again nationally. The last time it was really, 16. Obama, of course, carried Iowa twice, but then I think the change really started in 14 when Harkin gave up the seat that's up right now that we've been talking about. Joni Ernst won in a race that really wasn't that close. That seems to be when the tide turned before Trump, and then Trump's won really the three elections, not even close. And now, of course, Iowa Republicans have won a trifecta in the legislature, all four congressional seats. But Democrats have big hope, as Aaron has been talking about, for this fall to maybe getting some momentum back. And that brings us to the governor's race. Their big hope is of course, Rob Sand, who state auditor. He survived this Republican onslaught. But I think the big shock of the night reverberating across the country is what happened in the governor's race on the Republican side.
Without a doubt, Zach Lane edging out by a very close, very slim margin, Congressman Randy Feenstra. As I wrote in my story, this was an outcome that would have been unthinkable a year ago, maybe even a little less than a year ago, definitely a little less than a year ago, because Zach Lane wasn't in the race yet a year ago at this time, and wasn't for a few more months yet, and because he only recently moved back to Iowa, not a lot of people in this state, including Republicans, were very familiar with him. So it's a pretty remarkable outcome in where Zach Lane started from, taking on an incumbent congressman in the most conservative area of the state, and to do what he did last night was pretty amazing, honestly, and will be dissected and analyzed for days, weeks, months, and years to come, including in the Cedar Rapids Gazette tomorrow. Humble plug there. Working on that story as we speak. But it's been fascinating today to talk to people, to Republicans, to kind of get their sense and their initial reaction, because it's a big deal. It was By the time we got to the end of this thing, I will say this. It was still a surprise, but there was a sense that something was happening within these last few weeks on this campaign trail. I've told this story to others. If people have been asking me for months and months, what do you think about this primary? And for the longest time, my answer has been, I presume that what we all think is true and that Randy Feenstra's comfortably ahead in this thing. And I just won't give a different answer until I see something that makes me think otherwise. And that was my answer for the longest time. That answer started to change within these last couple of weeks, you know, between what you were seeing at campaign events, what you're seeing with the way the campaigns were advertising on TV and getting a little nastier there. Clearly something was happening. Clearly the way people were talking, the way Randy Feenstra's just supporters were talking at his events, people who were endorsing him, the way they were talking, clearly this thing was close. And so we knew something was possible. Maybe it was going to go to convention. Zach Lane winning this thing outright on primary election night, pretty remarkable stuff.
The initial comments I saw on Twitter last night when I was following this, or X, or whatever you want to call it, was that Feenstra was going to escape with a narrow win. But then it started changing as those votes came in. And I always look at these river counties over here. I still think they're going to decide things. Maybe I'm wrong. But they all went for Josh Turek. And most of them, except a couple, I think, went for Lane. Feenstra carried, I think it was Loiza and I think maybe Scott, I'm not sure. But the rest went for this guy. I mean, that's what was surprising to me. And the person, I can tell you right now, the person angriest over this isn't Randy Feenstra. He's the guy sitting in a White House. Because as listeners know, Trump endorsed Feenstra. And of course, Trump is accused anyway of picking people that are way ahead in the polls, like he was accused of doing in Texas with getting involved in that race.
Right.
I felt, Aaron, and I didn't you, that that was it. That was the icing on the cake. This thing might have been close, but it's over now because of Trump's popularity or is Trump's popularity taking a hit because of these tariffs?
Yeah, I will say this. When I based on conversations that I had with people, I wasn't sure that was going to be the winning play. If for no other reason, I think there's two questions we have now that'll be really difficult to parse out, and it's certainly in the immediate aftermath, if ever, because you really would have to get into the minds of voters and get some really good polling data on this. I think the question we have now, knowing that the Trump endorsement didn't result in Randy Feenstra winning this, the two questions are yours. Is his popularity maybe on a little bit of a downturn? Does his endorsement not carry as much weight maybe as we thought it might have? Or the other question, did it come too late? Didn't come until Friday afternoon, literally just 4 days to the polls opening. And as I noted in my story over this past weekend, after 15,000 votes had already been cast in an election that was ultimately decided by 1,500 votes. You know, that's if you were of the mind that endorsement could change minds, change voters who had been leaning to the one candidate or the other, but if they heard that President Trump was going to endorse Randy Feenstra, would change their mind, then a whole pile of 15,000 votes already been cooked into the books is a lot. That's a huge number. And so we may never know what might have happened. And now I'm literally plagiarizing from one of the sources I talked to today for my story that I'm working on. We may never know what might have happened if that endorsement had come even like a week earlier. You know, they came very, very late in the stages. So I think it's an open question that we may never get the answer to know the full effect or limit of effect.
The only way to know is if they poll late deciders, which can't do sometimes.
Yeah.
And that would be the way to find out if any campaigns were doing that or not. But I interviewed Feenstra late in the campaign, and he seemed very confident. And that one was a big surprise. And
We heard just, I'll just add to that. We just heard just enough, like I said, from people, even at his events. Like when Terry Branstad spoke at a fundraiser for him in the last week leading up, he said, this thing's close, getting to 35 is going to be tough. I mean, that kind of admission, that kind of talk on the campaign trail at an event and with knowing there's reporters there, That's not common unless they really believe that and really feel an urgency. So that's why I say what I mean when I say we had heard enough and seen enough things out there to believe that this thing actually was legitimately close and could go in any of a number of different directions.
Not sure there again. Issues, specific issues play a role. Unless it's more outsider insider, but I'm that pipeline issue. I felt all along was a sleeper because it's kind of broken up. You talk about national issues that have broken up the MAGA coalition. You know, the Iran war is one, but the pipeline issue does too in Iowa. And I'm just asking. I don't know. I don't have any evidence to base it on. But was there any light between the positions of Lane and Feenstra? Do you think this might have played a role?
I think that's a great point. I think that issue is one of the few that you might be able to point to in this primary that might have really pulled the votes apart. I think if you just put them both on the record, which we did. There isn't a ton of space between Feenstra and Zach Lane on eminent domain, ultimately. But I think if you listen to both, and if you sat in those rooms, if you're a Republican voter and sat in those rooms and listened to those two candidates, I think it's fair to observe that the Republicans who felt really strongly about this topic, and especially the ones that felt really strongly, are really strongly opposed to the use of eminent domain for these pipelines. I think Lane's message, Lane's delivery, his passion resonated more with those folks than Randy Feenstra, who I think those kind of folks felt maybe pulled himself along to the position that he did, that he was more a reluctant embracer of prohibiting eminent domain for pipeline projects. I think Lane was a candidate that they were more receptive to on that issue specifically.
In the end, why do you think Feenstra didn't catch on with more voters? He had all the advantages of being an incumbent congressman. He's been around this before. He's fundraised. He had all the advantages, Branstad endorsement. What happened?
Yeah, I think the one of the most common things I'm hearing is that he just wasn't out there enough in front of Iowans, in front of the voters. A lot of people have made a big deal about the debates and forums and how he skipped all of those. But I've talked to, I've heard from a couple of sources that it wasn't even just that. Like, you could have gotten away with that if you had also gone out and really campaigned the way basically the other four did, which was a very grassroots style barnstorming the state, constantly holding events, attending events, not just Zach Lane, but Adam Steen, Brad Sherman, and Eddie Andrews. They all did that to some degree, and all much more than Randy Feenstra did. And again, I've heard from multiple sources who have said that doesn't fly in Iowa. Iowa voters have been spoiled for a long time here with retail politicking, and the caucuses play a part of that, and they demand to see presidential candidates at their doorstep, much less a gubernatorial candidate, and so that's the one thing I've heard most often, is that he just wasn't out there in front of Iowa Republican voters enough, and that may have really hurt him again, and especially when you look at a result that wound up being very, very close.
talking just a little bit before recording that the turnout was up. The last I saw, the Democratic turnout was up about 10,000. I think the Republican turnout was up 30 or 40,000. That just portends a lot of excitement. You know, when you have open seats, that tends, for our listeners, that tends to increase turnout, a lot of attention. I assume that's going to continue right into November. I mean, what are we going to look for? We just got a couple minutes here to wrap up, and if you want to throw in any surprises or whatever from the congressional or state levels.
Yeah. No, I think you're right on there. It was, and it was interesting, too, because early voting numbers were actually down a little bit, so folks decided to come out on Election Day, and then there's a whole... We could talk another half hour about the kind of pattern and what may be going on there. But I think it makes sense given that the two competitive primaries statewide, one from each party, it seemed like there was a lot of interest in both of those. So to see those driving up turnout numbers isn't surprising. And I think you're exactly right. We're only going to see that continue as we get to the fall. There's a lot going on in Iowa with these two campaigns at the top of the ticket. There's going to be competitive congressional. People are going to be just bombarded with campaign ads. You're going to have to be on a different plan to not know that there's big elections in Iowa this fall. So I expect turnout to, you know, interest to be there, turnout to be up, and it'll be interesting to see how it goes. Outside of what we've already talked about, most of the congressional primaries went the way we kind of expected. No big shocks there. I'm a state house geek. You know, I do that for 4 months a year, every day at the Capitol during session. And we saw a couple of Republican incumbents lose primaries, which was fascinating. One by a dramatic margin, just unbelievable. If you look at the numbers, which I don't have off the top of my head, but it was a staggering margin for an incumbent to lose a primary by Brian Losey here in Bondurant in central Iowa, and Jane Bloomingdale was another one. But we some others survived some close ones too. Mike Buslow, who's kind of followed Jack Whitfer in the Ankeny and Grimes area, we had heard he faced a real stiff challenge, and he survived that one fairly comfortably. So it kind of went both ways too, which is kind of interesting and tough to draw, you know, real wider views of and what's going on. But we can talk about that on a later episode, because there'll be some interesting state houses to watch, races to watch this fall too, and in areas of the state as well. So they'll have to keep me busy this year.
There was an incumbent Democrat that lost here in Scott County too.
I'll be honest, I hadn't even seen that.
Yeah.
There you go.
It's just kind of interesting. There's an undercurrent of dissatisfaction in the country, I think, right now with both parties. And I think it's playing out to some degree against people that have been around a while. Not in all races, but that seems to be one of the undercurrents. Yep, we'll have a lot to keep us busy. Strap yourselves in, folks. It's going to be a lot of ads, a lot of talk, but Iowa's back on the political map, and that's a good thing. Aaron Murphy, political and government politics writer for the Gazette, has been my guest today to unpack the primary election. Aaron, thank you again so much.
Always a blast, Robin. Appreciate it.
You've been listening to Heartland Politics with Robin Johnson, a presentation of WVIK Quad Cities NPR. You can follow Heartland Politics at WVIK.org or wherever you subscribe to podcasts.